Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. Kim McKenzie Doyle is an award-winning product designer and has held significant roles in both the corporate and not-for-profit sectors, where she hones skills in leadership, strategic planning, product development and community engagement. With a passion for bridging the gap between industry and education, she is the founder of The Big Idea, a pioneering non-profit organization dedicated to empowering young people to tackle local and global challenges. The Big Idea is a multi-award-winning, free, creative thinking skills program for transition year students, which aims to fill the gap in our traditional education system that focuses on rote learning, which doesn't suit every student's brain type or learning style. Businesses and employers need creative thinkers. Creative thinking is now a more sought-after skill than big data or technical literacy. It's a critical skill recognized by the World Economic Forum and Forbes, yet it's not something that is taught in schools. The Big Idea has been instrumental in forging strong partnerships across borders, ensuring that young people across the island of Ireland receive the support and resources they need to thrive, and has garnered international recognition for its unique approach to education, focusing not just on academic success, but also on real-world problem-solving and creativity. The team are dedicated to fostering a generation of socially conscious and empowered individuals, and this dedication is evident in every aspect of the programme. Kim, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Aidan.
Now, first things first, right? I want to ask you about, you have a pretty big claim to fame from your life before The Big Idea. So tell me about that and we'll kick things off, because I think it might colour how what has happened post.
Yes, my nerdy claim to fame is I've designed the world's best-selling computer mouse. So in my tenure in Design Partners, that's now been bought out by PA Consulting, I was an industrial designer. So one of my projects and one of the clients that I work with was Logitech. And I couldn't tell you actually how many mice I've designed in my career. But one of them, the code name was Pharaoh, became the world's best-selling computer mouse and was on the market for well over 15 years, which is just phenomenal for consumer electronic.
Certainly is. And you get jettisoned all of that to move on and The Big Idea. Why did you set up The Big Idea? What's the thought process here?
I guess the origin story, when I was 3 years old, I suffered a really bad burn. And we were in the wilds of Scotland. There was, you know, nothing around. And my parents probably did what they weren't supposed to do, which was, you know, pull up the top straight away. It was just in my neck area, around my head. And we went to hospital and the doctors gave them a pretty impossible choice, which was tie me to a cot for 3 months or a skin graft, which could restrict movement. So they went with the cot, which basically, you know, I regressed all my milestones. I missed them. I went back into a nappy. I stopped speaking. I developed a speech impediment and just really became behind and very frustrated. So as soon as they let me out, I became like one of those little Tasmanian devils. I was just gone into the trees and I would only come back home when I was hungry. Mm. So school for me was an absolute nightmare. I think the first week I, you know, climbed out of a second story floor and tried to escape and I just could not sit still. So I was a real maker and breaker and fixer. I figured things out physically. I couldn't really explain myself very well because I had that speech impediment, but I was very eager. And so I eventually found my thing. But just before that, actually, my guidance counsellor told me to marry well.
At least guidance counselling has moved on from that point.
I know, thank God. But I did take their advice now. I do love my husband. But I eventually found my thing in college and not having a great academic result, you know, I just excelled once I found my thing. In college, I studied industrial design and it was kind of making and breaking and figuring things out and problem solving. So I learned these skills that just propelled me so much further than anything else I would experience, that I could learn how to succeed and be super, super successful. So I had an amazing career. I travelled all across the world and worked for the biggest companies, from startups to companies like Logitech and Google, and building systems and services that were probably a little bit unimaginable. So it was all just following the same process. And it was just a different way. So it was figuring out the right answer for someone or a company or a big, big problem. And I just found this kind of mind blowing that this kind of set of skills was not kind of freely available. And it was almost locked in industry. And we were so busy doing the day job because, you know, we're making companies, millions and billions. And we have become so commercially focused, which I totally get. But what would happen if we turned that type of skills onto the bigger challenges that we see on the news every day? So then, still in work and enjoying it and loving it, and then you have kids and you're like, ugh. Yep. the world's just not good enough for them. And it's a really, really scary place. And they're so innocent, and it's like, well, what can you do? So I packed in my lovely career and job and all the lovely salary and became a social entrepreneur and started The Big Idea and spent the first 3 months just talking to people, and half of them told me I was absolutely crazy and I could never do it, and I chose to ignore that.
And what are you trying to achieve with The Big Idea?
So it's really about democratizing that skill set and helping young people learn directly from industry in that set of problem solving skills. But there's so much around that. So it's, you know, communication techniques and really how to understand problems and get a deeper level of understanding. So if you see climate change on the news and there is like no way someone can think, oh, I can solve that. It's just too big. But if you break it down and really, share a very manageable way of the approach, you can make a difference. And it can be a small difference or it can be a really big difference. But everybody can do it. And doesn't matter their background, doesn't matter their ability. We've had neurodiverse students on the program that have just excelled through this process, and everybody gets value from it. So it can be really transformative. And I guess the big, big ambition is to get into the Department of Education so that we have 70,000 students going through this process, and it just unlocks potential that may not have been there before. And it gives students so much visibility on different pathways. The way we structured the program is we hear from real people doing really important things, utilizing these skills in a format that's super practical. And then we break that down to make it very understandable for young people, no matter their age. So we work with 13 right up to 19-year-olds, their youngest cohorts up in Northern Ireland. But typically it's transition year, LCA, Leaving Cert Applied, Youth Reach and CTC centres. So we've absolutely had our most transformational impact in Youth Reach centres with students that may have just kind of given up on education, or that they want to experience education in a different way and just need a little bit more support. And it's such a practical way of learning for mindsets that might not fit into the typical model of rote learning, that it gives them a route to, you know, an elevated way of thinking. So
it's not, you know, ultimately in these types of things, it's not about, you know, you're not trying to scrap the education system. What you're trying to do is find an alternative for those that the existing system might not suit.
Absolutely. And it's almost, when I say kind of filling the gap or bridging the gap, it's making these skills alive. So the education system in Ireland is actually really great because if you look at it on a world level, we're not doing too badly, but it just does not suit everyone. It's not built for everyone. It wasn't built for me, but it doesn't mean it did me any damage. But what it what I was probably slightly more behind than my peers, but I excelled once I found my thing. Mm. And there's so many people like that. There's so many entrepreneurs that maybe dropped out of school or didn't go to college because, you know, there was one way of learning. Now, things are changing, mm-hmm. which is fantastic, but it's a big ship.
Yeah.
It can't change that fast. And that's where we can become really, really agile. Well, we're 4 years old. We've modified the program year on year based on student and teacher feedback. So we're being really responsive to the needs of who we're working with and our mentors. So we take that industry knowledge by a third of the way. We've built an edtech platform. I should have really said that in.
and I was going to ask you about the mechanics of
how
it.
How do we do it?
Yeah. Let's go with that. So what are the mechanics of the big idea?
Yeah. So we've built this edtech platform that connects mentors digitally with students nationally. And so teachers basically register their class or their school and access 25 workshops, and they all build stackable skills. So if you take one workshop, for example, around empathy, say, we take that in a kind of a work life or scenario. So a mentor would communicate how they use empathy in work, with a client or with a problem or with a project. And then we show that in a societal aspect and how to use empathy. And then students also use that skill then practically on their own projects that they're working on through those 25 workshops. So they could be working on a AI for Humanity project. So they take those skills that they've learned through that workshop, and then they start that research with an empathetic viewpoint, gaining a deeper understanding of the problems and the challenges, and it really helps them to define an opportunity. So they come up with an idea for a project, and then they submit that to their mentors. I mean, each team would have 3 to 5 mentors from any sector. And again, we have CEOs to graduate, which is phenomenal to get in front of students. And they give them feedback through our platform, which goes to the teacher and then to the student. And then we have a whole session on taking feedback. I was never taught how to take feedback.
Very few of us were.
Yeah. So it's it really breaks everything down and helps students just accelerate their thinking, and they go into absolutely seventh gear when they get that feedback from mentors, and they kind of they talk about their mentors in the first name terms. So when we went to visit schools, they were like, "Oh, you know, Aidan said this, and you know, he was great, and he's doing this," and so it just absolutely really helps them understand that, you know, people in jobs just down the road are using these skill sets, and they're of a huge value to them going forward.
What do you think would be the sliding door moment for the big idea?
I think really integrating with the Department of Education to reach scale, because we have to have a national intervention, because we have some serious problems going on and they're not getting better. And I think with that collaboration piece between industry and unlocking that knowledge, the people that we have in Ireland is phenomenal. We actually even have international mentors involved, which is that want to have that Irish connection, which is incredible, and support something at home. But just to have that injection and intervention with industry stakeholders into education, it will just lift everything up. And it's changing people and mindsets and opportunities and energy levels. And we've seen students, there's one guy, Luke, in Tullamore, he completely reframed his career path through the programme. And one of his teachers mentioned that he now has hopes and he now has dreams and he is a way forward. And just to open that up for someone, it's, you know, that's why, you know, we work the long days and, you know, we ask people for support.
A lot of people, when they hear non-profit or charity, right, and they don't realise that this ultimately, end of the day, is managed in the same way any other business is, and it has
100%.
The same issues, and it's, you know, access to financing, getting revenue in, managing people, all of that type of thing. So Tell me about the extent of the operations behind the scene.
Oh yeah, I much prefer profit for purpose. and I guess that's where my experience comes in, because I've worked in a number of businesses, I've worked in startups. I know you need money. Mm. And you need to make the numbers work, and you need to have eyes on money. So from a very early days, I invested in the big idea. We're not like a typical startup where we can go out to investors and ask them to invest. Nobody owns the big idea. Mm. This is for Ireland. It's for your kids. So when we work with companies, they bring on teams, but they give us, you know, really essential finance to kind of keep this accessible and free to young people. And that's our biggest goal, is to keep it accessible. We've been, you know, quite good with grants, and a lot of them are competitive. So, you know, we're in the mix with some really big organizations, but we're doing well. But, you know, we have a team of 10. So I have that, you know, salary outlay every month in my mind, with all the financial projections done. And we have to have that runway, mm-hmm. and we have to make it work just like any business. So, but I think the challenge with being a social entrepreneur, or, you know, in that kind of nonprofit field, you have two bottom lines. You have the financial bottom line that you have to meet, but you also have the impact metrics that you have to meet for all your funders, for all your supporters. And that, you know, is very exciting, but very challenging when you're also trying to scale at the same time.
And then the other side, I suppose, to that is like most CEOs of organizations have their staff to deal with, and that's kind of it, and their customers. But you also have staff and volunteers or mentors to be managing, and you know, to be fair to them, they're giving up their time and trying to manage that relationship as well.
Absolutely. And that's where our platform does a lot of hard work for us as well. So our mentors are, you know, national spread. They have their own bespoke platform as well, where they interact with students, and we try and build a community, obviously digitally but nationally, but have online events where they can talk to us as well. So there's so many moving parts to what we do, that as we scale and really, really achieve the bigger numbers, that we have to make sure that we don't die in the process, that we're not killing the team. And I think we've been on such a steep trajectory over the last 4 years that it's now about mitigating any risk around, you know, us falling flat on our face from a pure exhaustion. You know, I operate a little toasty. I like, you know, I don't think I've ever burnt out, but I, you know, we worked to an extreme, and I think I've got that resilience, not through this, you know, the skills I've learned, but also in the kind of maybe corporate side where we're in consultancy. The deadline's the deadline. Mm-hmm. You meet it.
Yeah.
You know,
the talk to me about the relationship with sponsors, because you have some very high profile ones. I was interested to see that. So, you know, get new ones and cultural alignment and all of that type of thing.
Absolutely. So we've it's an amazing employee engagement experience for mentors at any level. So we've some phenomenal partners that have been with us day one. So MSD, we're one of the big originals. Autodesk have come on now. They're coming into our third year. MasterCard, we've just built a new relationship with as well. We had our big showcase with them. So it's really about connecting not only at national level, but directly with students. So it's a real kind of win-win. So it's, if you want to invest in your future workforce and Irish society, it's a great way to do it and to get the team involved. So it's very easy. It, you know, people like, oh, mentor, you know, it can be slightly intimidating, but we actually coach mentors on how to communicate with young people. And we've had even parents say, I'm actually talking to my kids in a different way now because I really understand how they're thinking. And then they're bringing kind of mentoring skills back into their work life scenario as well. So it's adding huge value back into, you know, commercial activities. So, and if we can communicate better and talk to each other in a more effective way, but a more meaningful way, the relationships are better, and everything is developed on relationships and understanding. And that's a big part of what we do in the Big Idea as well. So we've even been asked by companies to do a Big Idea for grown-ups.
Good luck with that one. What about then in terms of the sponsors and getting new ones and that idea of culturally being aligned to what you're trying to achieve?
Yeah. So I guess if a company wants to... not only give back, hit SDGs, if they want to kind of invest locally but nationally, then the Big Idea is a really great way of doing that, because we're connecting mentors that can be, you know, if you have a remote company or you're on one site, it's building like this network and visibility of your company directly into schools, into students and their parents. So the network and the ripple effect is really, really wide for the impact metrics that companies kind of really want to hit. So we've worked with actually Mercury Engineering as well, which is phenomenal. And they invested in their own apprenticeship program, which is amazing, because they've really, I guess, become aware of the need of an alternate way of thinking for their employees. So they just heard about the Big Idea and are like, yeah, makes complete sense. And it was one of the easiest conversations we've ever had, which is lovely.
Yeah, but it is, like, when you think about industries that, you know, there'll be an awful lot of industries out there for whom their next wave of talent coming through won't necessarily have, in fact, would be better off if they didn't come from the traditional education because of the nature of the business that they're in.
Absolutely. So it's like, you know, if any company, they hire for different perspectives, they hire for different mindsets. So it adds massive value. And unfortunately, we're putting people through almost like a funnel system for one way of thinking. There's certain ways of teaching that hasn't changed in decades, and yet industries, the rate of change is phenomenal. So we have to think differently, and this is something, the incredible stat of 85% of jobs in 2030 haven't been invented yet. So how do we educate people for that? We have to get them comfortable being uncomfortable, getting people to push themselves a little bit further, really trying to learn new things in new ways that define opportunities for growth, for impact, for a better way of living, and for commercial success. So it's an absolute no-brainer.
When you started this off and so far on this journey, to what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you?
I think we, as a designer, well, I'm quite a fan of failure, to be honest, because it's like...
that's where the best products are made.
Yeah, because that's where all the learning is. But it's just like, you know, failing fast, moving on. But actually understanding why. Right. It's the why behind it. And we do a whole week on flirting, which is one of my favourite words. It's like learning through failure.
Okay, flirting. That's a new one for me.
So it's normalising that because... everything's so glossy and so polished. Now, you know, social media has a lot to answer for.
Here's the one I prepared earlier.
Exactly. You know, just 24 hours later. there's so much that goes into so many things. But it's kind of normalizing the visibility around that. Mm. So it's discussing failure, discussing why it didn't work. And we've had projects that have gone back to the start in that week because it's like, okay, that's not going to work. This is the why. And they communicate that to their mentors, and their mentors are applauding it. And that's exactly what we want to see. So, you know, that's something that really, really has to happen, not only in industry, but, you applaud people that have the, I guess, the openness to communicate that, okay, that didn't work out, but won't happen again because I've learned this and this. You invest in that experience.
Which is the key way to deal, I suppose, not just in terms of product development or anything like that, but how you ultimately deal with setbacks as you come into your career or personally or anything else like that.
Absolutely. And relationships, for sure. And again, you know, if we... going back to my guidance counsellor saying marry well. I did. But it's, you know, it's not all glossy. But it's the same in work as well, and anything you put your energy into, you put in what you get out. And for me, we probably failed a lot behind, I guess, the Big Idea. But they're all they've all become leaps and bounds of progress because, you know, we had a few really tough times in the first iteration of the platform, and you definitely felt very toasty a couple of times, and we had to do a lot of manual work behind to get it through. We've shared that with mentors, and nobody noticed, and there wasn't an issue with their experience, but we felt it, and it's helped us develop a much better, you know, usability experience for mentors, and automate certain things that, you know, we couldn't cope with manually. So there's huge learnings for us. You know, we're trying to live what we're teaching at the same time. Yeah.
Do you self-analyze yourself or your decisions?
Well, now I am. I try not to overthink things,
right?
Because I think that it can be a little bit of, well, not maybe a waste of time. I think you have to appreciate where the learnings come from, but not to overthink things, because you can talk yourself out of, you know,
lots of things.
Yeah.
So does that mean do you obsess about the small things?
No.
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 Just wash off and move on.
Yeah. So my friends are very understanding.
I suppose the question I have, and it's an interesting one from a technology perspective, right? But and think about this not just with the big idea, but in terms of your own career development. There is this thing that as companies get bigger, the level of innovation falls in it, and it might not be a conscious thing, but, you know, how do you look on that? Do you think it is the case? How do you think people should overcome it themselves, or in the commercial world, how you can overcome it?
It's making the room to fail,
right,
to be honest, because that's when the real innovation happens. So and we it's really tough to do that in the big idea as well, because we've so many things and moving parts happen. And I totally get, when you get to that scale, you have numbers to meet, and that's where the focus is. But if you allow room, and you have almost like a weak innovation, you know, we see, I love the hackathons that happen within some companies, because it's just, you know, throw all the rules out the window and just have a go. So there's something about, you know, the collaboration aspect, mixing people up, chucking the rule book out the window and just having a go at something. You know, maybe it's a one-line problem statement that you share with the team, mix people up. You know, there's so many ideas and knowledge that are there, but they just might not have an opportunity to communicate it. So it's really about leaving room.
And it's funny, because one of the other guys that we've had on the show, the guys from Convergent, said that an awful lot, when they're dealing with a lot of their customers, the one thing that comes back is that everybody is so busy doing the day job, they never get the opportunity to get in a room together and think about what isn't the Monday to Friday job, what is the job of 3 months' time, 6 months' time, 2 years' time.
Yep, absolutely. And we're going through a process now, through our first strategic plan. And it's about, right, what are the what ifs? But it's not just me doing it, it's the whole team. And we've had people with education backgrounds talk about, you know, the tech, and it'd be great if it could do this. And you're like, yes, that's a no-brainer. And then you can build backwards from then on. So it's about capturing the super, super high-level ideas, and then you can work backwards to make that happen. And it might not be tomorrow. It might take a couple of years to get in place. But
you have to be doing it, and you can't let the day-to-day firefighting get
absolutely
in the way of that.
Absolutely. So there's definitely part of being organised, but it's having a little bit of chaos in the mix. And I'm very comfortable with a little bit of chaos.
What's the hardest part of the job as a CEO?
It's a good question. I think you can chuck balance out the window. I think you hear so much about work-life balance, and it's probably more like work-life integration. So there's definitely that. And I think the other struggle I face is I still want to do the fun stuff. And I am 100% on a mission to make time for myself to do that, because I can add a huge amount to the big idea with that type of experience that I've had over the years. I hate the admin. I'm not if you think about difficult conversations, I'm getting much better with having really hard conversations. Mm. I was probably brutal with, not brutal, but very hard with clients, even really challenging, because that's what you do as a, like an industrial designer. You want to push the boundaries. So very open to that. But it's slightly different when you're communicating with different types of people and mindset. And as the team grows, you're trying to, I guess, make sure everybody comes along the same journey. But we're hiring different types of people, and that can be much more challenging.
Challenging to manage those different ones. Let's talk about governance, right? Because this is the other thing for non-profits and for businesses. Like, you have a board. What are the types of people that you have on the board or want on the board that might well be a different type that you would have on, say, a normal company board?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So we've the Avengers of board members. So it's chaired by Joe Hogan, who's a former EY Entrepreneur of the Year. So I think day one, it was like, right, we need a heavyweight as a chair who's done this before, who knows how to scale and knows how to think really, really big. So Joe was a no-brainer. And he came up in conversation with somebody who I really admire, Emily Ross, who's in, I don't like X, but you know Twitter. And she's just phenomenal. And she mentioned Joe and she was like, whatever you do, don't ask him when you're bored, because she knew exactly what I was thinking. I was like, okay, yeah, no problem. So as soon as I got in front of him, you know, you might only get one chance in front of people, I asked him and he was like, okay. So he came on board, which was phenomenal. So Joe's our chair, and then we have board members, again, really diverse backgrounds. We've Paul Sweetman, who's CEO now of the American Chamber, so, but he's come from, a tech background. And we have people from Salesforce, Microsoft, you know, all the big tech companies. We have actually somebody from Davy. Mm-hmm. We have Sinead, and she's head of risk, and I'm going to get her title wrong now, governance compliance. So she keeps manners on us. It's about bringing the different perspectives that also make sure that we're not going too far too fast so we don't fall on our face, but also make sure that we have that runway to keep doing what
we're
doing.
Sitting on your laurels.
Exactly. Yeah. And the team are doing what, you know, we're supposed to be doing. Mm. So it's absolutely critical that we have good people behind us. And there's complete clarity. They know, you know, what's going on at the base, and they know what's going on at a really, really high level. And we're actually redoing the strategic plan with their advice, because what we're doing is breaking down all the objectives, because we're super ambitious, but it's like, how do we get there? So we're going now to the nth level. So we're probably having one of the most detailed strategic plans I think I've ever seen, because I've done so much research into others, that it's just going to make a lot of things a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On that point then, who have you, or who do you seek advice from?
Well, I'm very open for asking for help. Right. So, you could be on the list.
Right. Happy to.
Fantastic. So, and I think when you ask for advice and you share knowledge, it works both ways. It's reciprocal. I'm really open with a lot of information and things I've learned. It's such a good sounding board. In the early days of the big idea, I didn't know what good looked like for our stage development. And now I'm much more comfortable with, I don't need to know that. We just need to do what's right for us. Yeah. So it's about probably developing confidence, but using people as almost like a touchstone of information when we need it, and then learning from people who might have actually failed as well, I think is super important, because...
And succeeded.
Oh, absolutely. But it's, you can't succeed without the failure. Yeah. So behind every success story, there's five failures.
How important do you think personal networks are?
Massively. Right. Oh, yeah. So I made it my business. I lived in a lovely bubble in design land and really loved what I was doing. The world was perfect. But it was like, you kind of look outside and you're like, actually, I don't know anybody outside, you know, the core.
The ecosystem that I'm in.
Yeah. So, and I just knew the power and the potential of what I was doing. So I was like, right. And I kind of almost like looked to the left. And I got involved with the Institute of Designers Ireland, and then eventually became president. And I And the whole year, I just took about talking to different types of people. What were you doing? Why were you doing it? And I learned so much from that experience that that gave me a massive grounding mm-hmm. for the big idea. And basically, that network that I developed from there helped. We're the first 100 mentors for the first 500 students.
Right.
And it was very easy conversation. It was like, I need your help. Yeah, no problem.
It is quite amazing. Like, I talk to entrepreneurs all the time too. And the one thing about Ireland is there's very few people out there who, if you send an email or pick up a phone and ring them and ask them to have a chat, that they'll say no.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I've never had that.
Yeah.
And the energy that it gives you as well, I think it just gives you that boost, because it's almost like a little bit of a form of therapy, to be honest. You know, you find your tribe and yeah. you know how other people think and at a common level, and it just gives you that boost to kind of keep going. And they're like, yeah, you're doing it, it's great. And then, you know, vice versa. And I've had students and I've had people starting off that I've talked to, and they're like, do this, don't do that, and do this, do this. And it's been, you know, a game changer. It saves so much time in a lot of regards.
Fast or slow decision making?
Ooh. I would be a devil for fast decision making because I love to keep up momentum.
Yeah.
And it's worked about 90% of the time for me.
Yeah.
So I'll keep going with that.
Okay, fair enough. And I know the big idea is a tight group, but
yes.
Where are you on hiring talent or developing from within?
Well, we would love to hire more talent, but we definitely need more funding to do that. So there's no immediate, there's a want, but there's no immediate investment that way at the moment. But so it's really about elevating the internal talent. Mm-hmm. We're making our lives nice and hard by having a new start date in September, which is really exciting. And we're moving the whole program eventually to a September start date to May. So all eyes are on that. But we, you know, for us, we definitely need, we have nobody in communications. Mm-hmm. So we're punching well above our weight with nobody with a marketing background.
Yeah.
We have no dedicated fundraiser, which is mind boggling. So it's spread amongst the team. So we've learned as we've gone and become quite successful at it. And you know, we still need to have more time. I think that's one of our crucial challenges. And I think you talk to any social entrepreneur and it's time.
Yeah. You mentioned funding.
Yes.
What is the funding model? And, you know, you can have a shameless plug here. How can listeners get the word out there for you?
Say, oh, thanks, Aidan. Brown envelope later on.
Jesus, don't be saying that.
No, I'm only messing. I'm only messing.
The regulator will be on me.
I'm only messing. No, so we have corporate partners. So if you'd like to onboard a team as mentors, we have different packages, which actually makes the program free. So it's typically €250 per student is the cost, completely free from September to May on the program. We have obviously. We have philanthropists as well that we work with. So if you'd just like to give us a big bunch of money and put it to really, really good work, your money will never work so hard as it will in the big idea and have so much potential. And my husband told me not to be that direct. But
direct wins all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. We need help. And it's a constant. It's a hamster wheel. I'm designer turned fundraiser. And I have no problem doing that because I know the potential and the absolute impact it's having right on the ground for Ireland. So it's really exciting.
Now, and this is the interesting one, because you've 4 years now, you're in going into the fifth year,
yep.
Right? And if you think about it, the kids, let's say the transition, so they're 15, 16, you know, it'll be another 5 years before we see the evidence of the thing. And it will
yeah.
be gradual and things like that. But longer term, what does success look like for the big idea?
That's a really good question. I think for us, it's having a generation of individuals that can take on any challenge, large or small, and get, you know, tackle them head on. We want a generation of individuals that, you know, work better together, work better for our society. Ireland being basically the innovative capital of the world because we have those mindsets ingrained in every person. And then for us, it's integrated into the Department of Education so that every young person gets this skill set year on year. And we can support the department basically because we're so agile, because we have that industry connection. And it's just so much more seamless. So there's a lot of goals for us. It could absolutely go global. But for us, we've eyes on an All-Ireland programme. And we've entered into Northern Ireland education system, which is fantastic. We'll have about 600 students starting in September. But, you know, that there's challenges in that in itself.
Yeah. Is there any reason why it wouldn't work in the UK or it wouldn't work elsewhere?
Not at all. We've actually had schools. We had a Spanish school sign up yesterday. We had to email them and say, sorry,
we can't do it.
Yeah.
And the other thing I suppose that I thought of, you know, transition year, student 16, is it too late? Like, ideally, would you prefer to be having this at first year students in secondary or last year in national school? Or does it not work at that younger age group?
I think for us, it was definitely the easiest entry route into schools, which is transition year, because they have the time, which is phenomenal for students. They get that visibility of a lot of different experiences. So for us, it was getting into schools, making sure that we communicate that this works and this has massive value and, you know, people can access it. So it was, you know, proving it. We actually had to do the programme without any money to prove that this is viable and has massive impact. So for us, it's really about, I guess, getting the access to a wide level so that every young person has it. But a great way at 15 is you're kind of deciding on the directions that you're going to take because you've already in the system. So, you know, some things are going to work for you, some things aren't. Primary school is actually pretty phenomenal in Ireland because you have one teacher teaching a diverse range of subjects in alternate languages. So the information is retained in a different way. And then when you get into second level, obviously you have so many teachers teaching so many different things that...
And a focus on a set of exams at
exactly.
the end of each thing.
Exactly. It's numbers driven. Yeah. So we try and remove all of that and give them maybe a new direction and a new set of skills that they're applicable not only to senior cycle into Leaving Cert, but beyond that. So it's about kind of opening up the opportunities. So for us, it's a really good age range, but it's about compounding these skills and make sure the retention.
Going forward.
Exactly.
Right. Now, we've come to the final question. I'm opening up the black book. Don't know what's in it, so here we go. Now this is going to be an interesting one. Who is your biggest inspiration and why?
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's a hard one. I think, I would love to have a longer think about this one.
Here we can take your time.
I think a lot of people inspire me because I try to get in front of a lot of people and I take different things from different
people.
Yeah. I really like, there's so many. And I'm becoming political because if I don't see this person, they're going to get upset.
I'll give you a separate one, right?
In
terms of inspiration, as a product designer, is there anybody that inspires you?
Well, there's a lot of people that annoy me as a product designer. Rather than inspire, I'm frustrated by. Oh no! I think anybody that really puts themselves out there needs to be admired. As I'm moving, and I don't think gender is an issue, but as I'm moving, obviously, my experience level as a female CEO, anybody who has made it to a certain level in corporate land as a woman, and it's really annoying me actually that I'm calling this out, that has survived, I think is, you know, it just blows me away, because not only do have they juggled, you know, what's exists out there with biases, they've put a pathway for the generation that's coming behind them. So anybody that's left a field that is doing something that they've has never done before, that's, I always draw inspiration from that.
Particularly where they may be in an industry that are, that's a male-dominated industry. We had Jacqueline O'Donovan, from, who was the CEO of O'Donovan Waste Management.
Yeah.
Very much a traditional male-dominated industry, yeah. You know, and she is she ran the largest waste disposal company in London, you know.
Yeah.
She was phenomenal, you know.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Because in industrial design, there's only 5% of women in there, which is mind-blowing when you're thinking about products for humanity.
Yeah.
Which is just mind-blowing. And it's actually really dangerous. And that's why I was saying I'm so frustrated about being a product designer.
Yeah.
And there was no female industrial designers when I was in, where I never met one.
Yeah.
And so whenever I met a younger industrial designer, I made a beeline for them.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if you need anything,
you know where I am.
Yep. Yep.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Kim McKenzie Doyle. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoy what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.